Holy moly. Can we start by acknowledging that golf is just a really bad spectator sport? Now, I've never actually been to a golf tournament, but I have been subjected to golf on TV, which even saying it out loud is a little tricky. One of the reasons it's such a bad sport is nothing really good ever happens. And the other reason it's a challenge is because if something good does happen, you're not supposed to applaud raucously. If something good happens, there's this sort of anemic, wimpy golf applause thing. So if you could just humor me for a minute, give me the worst, weakest golf applause you can muster. That was terrible. Thank you very much. Now, can you double it? Pretty good. Double it one more time. Thank you. And finally, double it one last time. Beautiful. Okay, stop. That's what we do for a living now. And that's what I came to talk about. What we do for a living now is not assault strangers with our latest widget, hoping that they'll turn around and buy it from us. What we do for a living, as David has written so beautifully about the Grateful Dead, is find little bits of threads, little threads of interest, little separated pockets of people who are interested, and then we connect them and we amplify them and we take them to the next level. And I've been talking about this for a couple of years, but what I don't usually talk about is what does that mean you have to do? Not your organization, not your strategy document, what do you have to do? And that's what we're going to talk about today. And I brought a couple stories with me, and I think we'll start with this one. I don't know if you've ever seen this before. This is I'm shaking just holding it. This is Lamb Chop. Lamb Chop was a popular TV sock puppet, probably the most popular TV sock puppet of all time. And Lamb Chop played a big role in my life. I've spent 30 years making projects. And at the beginning, some of the projects I did were software, some of them were videotapes. And I did a videotape for kids that was published by Kodak. And then I got the big news that it had been nominated for an American Film Institute Award. Now, the American Film Institute is just like the Academy Awards, except not nearly as good. And it was in the children's video category, so we thought we had a good chance. The only other thing that was nominated was Lamb Chop, a sock puppet. So I rented a tuxedo, flew out to LA. It was a very big deal. Bruce Jenner was there, Kathy Rigby, Gary Coleman. These were the hosts. And they get to my category, and they say, and the winner is, and I stand up to start to give my speech, and they say, Lamb Chop. And I was just crushed, because in the moments before that, I said to myself, finally, I'm gonna get picked. Finally, I will have this badge of approval. Someone will say, yes, you're the one. And then all the projects after that would come easy, because then we'd have this badge. We'd have this ability to say, yeah, we're the ones who won that award. But we didn't win the award. We lost to a sock puppet. And it was a very long flight home with a plane ticket I really didn't have money to afford in the first place, with a rented tuxedo crumpled up in my bag. There's a quote from Leonard Bernstein that I wish I had coined, but it came to me somewhere along the way. And what he said is, I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but I know that the answer is yes. And what happened to me after that was an understanding that over time, I was going to have the privilege, if I wanted to do the work I wanted to do without wondering whether I could get picked, without wondering whether an authority could say, yes, it is your turn to do this right now. Go ahead and do it. My friend Michael Schrage has written about what great organizations do. And his term for it is, who do you want your customers to become? And I've riffed it into, what change are you trying to make? So if we think about Harley-Davidson is a fabulous brand worth billions of dollars, not because they make great motorcycles. Their motorcycles, by most measure, aren't great. They are a brand that matters because they have turned a group of people from outsiders to insiders, a group of people who used to be disrespected, who when they come together around the brand, feel something. They have made change happen. A whole bunch of people are going to get in line a week from now to get the latest phone that isn't even a good phone because Apple Computer has changed us into people who have good taste about digital goods. And part of what it is to have good taste is you need the next thing. Part of what it is to have good taste is when you walk into a store that isn't theirs, you feel just a little off. So if we are going to do this work that matters, the question is, what does that mean for us? And for me, it comes down to a very difficult decision that we have to make, and that's the decision I want to talk to you about today. So that's the second thing I brought. This is a spot. And what it means to do this work is that you have to be on the spot. You have to be the person who says, I am going to do this. Not the person who says, this is my job to do it. Not the person who says, the dummies book said I could do this. Not the person who says, well, this is what everyone else is doing. Because the work that matters, the work we have the opportunity to make, is never work that other people could do. It's never work that's being done by lots and lots of people. It's work that's being done when we would miss you if you were gone. We would miss you if you didn't do that work. And there are a couple elements of this work, of being on the spot, that I want to talk about. The first one is this. Most of us work in organizations, and organizations are obsessed with authority. Can he do that? How come he didn't ask me if he could do that? Can I do that? Who has the authority to do this? Who has the authority to spend for this? Give me a raise so I can tell other people what to do. And this search for authority informs most of the bureaucracies in our life. If you only had more authority, the thinking goes, then you could get on the spot and do this work. No one's giving you more authority anytime soon. But there's something else that's available, and you can take it anytime you want. And that is responsibility. People who take responsibility get responsibility. We don't give it to you, you take it. And what comes with it is the willingness to give away credit. If you are giving away credit and taking responsibility when things go wrong, there's a long line of people out the door who want to work with you. And this is super hard, because not only do you have to go on the spot and say, I am going to do this, but then you have to be responsible for what happens next. Which leads to this huge idea about change. Because I said 2 minutes ago that when we're doing work that matters, we are changing other people. There are two challenges when we change other people. One, other people don't want to be changed because it might not work. And two, we don't want to be responsible for changing other people. So it creates tension. Tension in us, tension in them. Think of a great artist right now, a great artist who lived in the last 100 years. Can you visualize this person? This person created art that was almost universally hated when it first came out. Whether it's, you know, John Cage or Jackson Pollock or somebody who's making an edgy opera. All of it is hated. And that person stands up and says, no, 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 I'm making it anyway. So when my friend Amanda Palmer stood in Harvard Square dressed in a bride's dress for 3 years. People came and they spat on her and they yelled at her and they threw things at her and they drove away. And then she started making music and sometimes people would walk out, but that was okay because it was her responsibility and she wanted to make a change. And that tension that she was willing to create, that tension is now available to more of us than ever before. The internet could save your life. Not in the sense that it could keep you alive, but it could save your life because it could keep you from a lifetime of being a drone, from a lifetime of drudgery, from a lifetime of doing what you were told. Because here we have a new economy. It's not an economy based on what can you make. It's an economy based on who can connect, who can trust you, who can listen to you. So if we all go all the way back 16 years ago to permission marketing and go forward, it's all been a progression about can you be heard, can you be trusted, can you connect, can you do this work that matters? So there was a study done a couple years ago. I want to make sure I get the statistics right. Jake Halpern did it for a book. 650 students in Rochester at a high school. Turns out Rochester is demographically, Rochester, New York, demographically perfect, just like the United States overall. Income, gender, race. They surveyed 650 high school students. And one of the key questions they asked them was, here are five jobs that you could have when you grow up. Which one do you want? The choices are chief of a major company like General Motors, a Navy SEAL, a United States Senator, the president of a university like Harvard or Yale, or the personal assistant to a very famous singer or movie star. 43% of the people surveyed picked the last one. 43% of our future, 43% of these high school students said, my number one choice is to be the assistant to a celebrity. And if you think about it, the reason is obvious. Because you get all the credit of being able to brag about who your boss is and none of the responsibility. You can go run and get coffee and no one's going to blame you because you know how to get coffee. That what we were raised to do again and again and again is do things that work. Which leads to the next thing I want to talk about. This is the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. I know you've been waiting for him to make an appearance, and after all these years of you coming, here he is. Now, I brought the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man for a reason. I want to talk about the famous marshmallow study. Here's how it went. Some evil scientists took three-year-olds. They did this in 20 countries around the world. They take three-year-olds, and they put the three-year-old in an academic library, and they sit her down at a table, and they walk up to the kid, and they say, here's a marshmallow. I'm going to leave this room for 15 minutes. And when I come back, if the marshmallow is still here, you can have two marshmallows. But if you eat the marshmallow, sorry, no more marshmallows. And they leave the room. Some kids eat the marshmallow. Some kids don't eat the marshmallow. And they videotape the whole thing. And then they wait 15 years. 15 years. They find the kid, and they look him up. They look her up. And it turns out that the kids who didn't eat the marshmallow, by every measure, more successful, better SAT scores, go to a more famous college, report themselves to be happier, have a better future ahead of them. So the first question is, did the test change the kids? If so, let's do a lot of tests. Probably not what happened. Probably what happened is the test is a symptom of the ability to keep two ideas in your head at the same time. I want the marshmallow, I want two marshmallows. People who can keep those two ideas in their head at the same time at the age of three have the grit and the self-determination to do other things that are difficult. So here you are now, almost everyone in this room is more than 3 years old. What are the two ideas? The two ideas are it might work and it might not work. And the only way you can do something new is if you can hold both of those ideas in your head at the same time. Only a fool does something brand new and says it's going to work for sure. And only a failure refuses to do something that isn't guaranteed to work. When we do our best work, we have to walk into it saying it might work and it might not work. So Bob Dylan comes along. Bob Dylan gets to a great start. But then he stops getting picked. He doesn't become the Beatles. He becomes this guy who some people are obsessed with and other people want nothing to do with. And Bob Dylan again and again and again reinvents himself. Every 7 years he gets booed off stage. Right? He did a gospel record, he gets booed off stage. He does an oddball Christmas record, he gets booed off stage. Over and over again, Bob Dylan says to himself, I'm going to do something new to change the people who are going to listen to this. It might work, and it might not work at the same time. A lot of you are familiar with Marc Maron's work. Marc Maron started the arc of his latest career by being rejected by Saturday Night Live. He's talked about it at length. That getting turned down by Lorne to be a member of the cast put this giant black mark on him. He didn't get picked. So how is it that all of a sudden everyone knows who Marc Maron is? Because he didn't wait to get picked. What Marc Maron did instead is hold two ideas in his head at the same time. He doesn't do the same show every time. He does a show that might work or a show that might not work. Both of them at the same time. Now, it's easy to have a narrative in our head that says, well, this is for other people. This is for gifted people. I need to stay within the range. I need to tweet at certain times of the day because they have been scientifically proven to have the most efficacy. And I make sure that I use these magic seven words because I read that once in a manual. Being in the center of the pack is a lot safer. So I was in India a little while ago, and I am in love with the people and the spirit there, but I'm still amazed at the driving. So let me explain a little bit about the driving, because I had to go from Delhi to Bareilly, and that's 300 miles. First, everyone drives on the wrong side of the road. They should fix that problem. But the second thing is people honk. They honk when you're going too fast. They honk when you're going too slow. They honk when they're right behind you. They honk when they're not right behind you. They honk when it's your time to go. They honk when it's not your time to go. So there's an enormous amount of honking. So I'm in this van driving on the wrong side of the road on this 300-mile-long trip, and my driver is in a hurry. And it's a two-lane road, so you know people are doing this and zigging and that, and again, my life is passing before my eyes on a regular basis. And he's honking, and he's passing every single person he can pass. Passing. And finally, after 2 hours, there's no cars in front of us. After 2 hours, he has passed everyone he could pass, and there's 10 miles of straightaway right in front of us. You know what he did? He slowed down. Because there was no one to pass. So we let other people define our agenda. Because it's one thing to say, well, yeah, because these people are doing it, I'll just go almost as fast as them, or I'll go even a little faster than them. But if we look at the pioneers, even in social media, all the people who went first didn't go first because they were going faster than someone in front of them. There was no one in front of them. That the art that's available to us isn't the art of Jackson Pollock. It's a different kind of art. It's the art of changing other people. And the way we make change happen is by being human, by being connected, by being generous, and by doing something that might not work, that changes someone else for the better. So no one waits in line to go see copies of paintings that happen to be in the Isabella Gardner Museum. They want to see the original one, the first one. That one, the original one that made it into the museum. Why did it make it into the museum? It made it into the museum because some people didn't like it. Because it went to an edge, because it touched us, because it changed us. So here's part of the challenge. Part of the challenge is we spend a lot of time shaving yaks. Yak shaving, if you haven't been on the internet for 20 years, is a simple concept. Your husband says, you promised you were going to mow the lawn, and you didn't. He bothers you a few times, you realize you got to mow the lawn. You go to the garage to get the lawnmower, it's not there. You remember why you loaned it to your neighbor. You go to your neighbor to get the lawnmower, and you say, I need my lawnmower back. The neighbor says, I'll give you your lawnmower back, but first I need that sweater you borrowed from me 3 months ago that you never gave back to me. Well, you go home to get the sweater, but you realize you lent the sweater to your daughter and you don't have it anymore. And the sweater was made out of yak hair. And therefore, you find yourself in the middle of the night breaking into the zoo to find a yak and shave him so that you can weave it into yak wool and knit a new sweater so you can get your lawnmower back. Basically, what you're doing is getting all your ducks in a row. And we are spending an enormous amount of our time, you and me, in social media world, trying to get these ducks in a row. You know, I just need a little bit more juice on Facebook. I need some more followers. Our funnel needs to be adjusted. We need to figure out how to have more interactions with these people. Like if you watch Mad Men, it's positively relaxing. They make an ad, they run it, they're done. And we, you guys, are constantly getting all these ducks in a row. The question is, once you get them, what are you going to do with that duck? What's the duck for? Who are you trying to change? Are we trying to win this tiny little race? Or are we trying to make a bigger difference in the world? Ellen Langer writes about the idea that some people are walking around with a giant bowl of frogs. And what they're trying to do is keep all the frogs in the bowl. And if you're sitting there focusing and wondering about your boss and your boss's boss and all those people who are following you, and how do I keep those ducks in a bowl? You can't possibly do that work that you are actually here to do. That sometimes we've got to let some frogs jump out. Because keeping the frogs in the bowl isn't the point. The point is to make change happen. And somewhere along the way, when you try to make change happen, someone's going to come up to you and say, you're not as good as you think you are. Someone's going to come up to you and say, how dare you do that? Who gave you the authority to say that or make that or do that? Exactly. When Brené Brown wrote her first book, she had never written that book before. When Brené Brown gave that magical TED talk, she had never given that talk to that audience before. That when we think about anyone who has touched us, who has moved us, who has made something that mattered, that person was completely unqualified to do the work they had just done because they had never done it before. All the things that get you hired for a job, the resume, the proof that you've worked for the famous brands, the proof that you can follow instructions, none of those things are actually relevant to you doing great work. We spend hours every day in meetings. What are we doing in those meetings? What we're doing in those meetings is waiting for someone else to take responsibility. It's a whole bunch of people sitting in a circle waiting for one person to say, I'll do it. And then the other thing we do is we compromise, and then we compromise again. So I want to talk for a minute about the difference between quality and deluxeness, and then contrast it with its enemy. Deluxeness means super fancy, expensive. That's not what quality is. Quality means meeting specifications. Quality means being good at what it's supposed to be good at. And all of us would like to believe we make a quality product. And then we go to meetings. And what happens in meetings is our quality product becomes crappy. Because crappiness is about compromising so you can get it out of the meeting. Crappiness are all the edges we sand off to make everybody happy. But we make everybody happy, we don't do anything for the people at the edges. We don't do anything for the people who care. And when we sand those edges off, we lose. My friend Michael Landau and his sister started a chain of stores called Dry Bar. And if you go to Dry Bar and say, would you cut my hair, they will say no. And if you go to Dry Bar and say, can you please give me a blowout, the place next door is half the price, can you give me a discount, they will say no. And if you go to Dry Bar on a Thursday afternoon without an appointment, they'll say, we're sorry, we're taking care of people. There are a lot of edges at Dry Bar. Dry Bar flies the same architect that built the first store to every single city they build a new one in. If you talk to Danny Meyer about how he built Shake Shack into a $1 billion company in just a few years, he didn't do it by figuring out how to be McDonald's but cheaper. He didn't do it by figuring out how to be Chipotle but hamburgers. He did it by being Danny Meyer. He did it by making something that some people won't wait in line for, which is how you make something that other people will wait in line for. And so now we get to this key fork in the road, which is we would like to be let off the hook. The hook that says you're responsible. We'd like to say, well, this organization does this, and I apologize, but my boss won't let me. Of course your boss won't let you. Your boss won't let you because you're coming to her and saying, I got this crazy idea, I want to do this really big thing. If it works, I'll get the credit. And if it doesn't work, you'll get the blame because you said, okay, can I start? What boss would say yes to that? Nobody. Instead, what we see in organizations is that someone who cares starts with connection, right? They start with this idea of saying, I can talk to that customer or that engineer or that process person. And then they do something for which they will take responsibility but have no authority. And as soon as it works, they tell somebody else they can take the credit, and then they do something again. And then they do it again. And bit by bit by bit, these people, whether they're a company of one or a company of 100 or a company of 1,000, show up. They show up for the right reason, to make change happen, to change the person they are working with, to look at them in the eye as a human being and say, I am not here as a celebrity assistant, right? I am here to make change happen. And the only way you can do that is by being the best in the world, the irreplaceable one, the linchpin. My friend, the late Lionel Poulain, baked bread in Paris. And it was a scandal because his father had been a bread baker and Lionel refused to make French baguette because the regulations meant that the baguettes he would have to make would be crappy. And he said, I don't want to make a crappy product, even if it's the only legal way to do it. So he refused. He made a different loaf of bread that stood for something in a bakery that did it a different way. When he expanded, he refused to expand the normal way. Instead, he replicated his bakery 12 times in a circle. So there would be a big pile of dough in the center and 12 bakers, with each baker responsible for what that baker did. Responsible, not just authority. At one point, almost half the 2- and 3-star restaurants in all of Paris sold Lionel's bread. This was a man who stood for something. Then when he had a chance to open a store in New York, he said, I cannot open a store in New York because by the time the bread comes to me for me to taste it to see if it's any good, it will be too late. This wasn't about how do we get bigger. This wasn't about how do we win some race. How do we get more likes? How do we show up number one in some pile of results? It's how do we choose to matter? That choice is in front of you perhaps for the first time ever, because you don't need to own a retail establishment. You don't need to have dozens of employees. If you have a laptop or a smartphone, we just gave you a connection machine that connects you to more than a billion people. The very same connection machine the biggest companies in the world have to work with. I almost didn't make it here today because there was a huge accident on the Merritt. Fortunately, it was going the other direction. So those people definitely did not make it here today. But if you get, thank you, I'll be here all week. If you get caught in traffic on the Merritt, you're doomed because there's only 2 lanes. It's not like India. You can't honk your horn and go around everybody. But now, if there's traffic, you can just go around. If you don't get picked by Lorne Michael, go around. If it's not working in this venue, go around. If people don't get the joke, you look them in the eye with utmost respect and say, it's not for you. I made this. It's not for you. Go look at the reviews of any one of the top 100 books on Amazon. Every one of them has 1-star reviews. What's that about? What it's about is, of course, they have 1-star reviews because they can't be for everybody because they're bestsellers. The only things that go to the bestseller list are things that are for some people. So here we are. We built this system for you. And you tell me you have writer's block. You tell me you don't know what to say. You tell me you can't think of anything good. Well, as DMS just mentioned, where is he? He's in here. Not David, this. The lizard is present, right? The lizard brain, the amygdala right back here, is the source of you being stuck. Here's what we know. There is no such thing as writer's block. We know in the 1800s, people wrote. The word writer's block did not tend to appear in the literature until the 1940s. Where did it come from? Where it came from is suddenly writing became a profession. Suddenly writing could make you famous. Suddenly Ernest Hemingway. Suddenly Harper Lee. Of course you have writer's block because you're not qualified like Harper Lee was. She, after all, had written, no books before she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. And so we run into Stephen King and we say, Stephen King, you're one of the most famous authors of all time. Please, please tell me, what kind of pencil do you use? Because if we just knew what kind of pencil Stephen King used, we could get that pencil and a Moleskine or some other clever Italian notebook in which to write, and then we'll be fine. There's no such thing as writer's block because there's no such thing as talker's block. The reason that you get writer's block is because the lizard brain doesn't want you to be responsible. The reason when someone says, are there any questions, most people don't raise their hand isn't because they don't have questions. It's because they're saying to themselves, well, if I raise my hand and ask a question, my boss might hear what I said. And she might realize I said something stupid. And then she would check my resume and see that one thing I said in the resume that wasn't true. And then my phone would ring and it would be her. And she would call me into the office and she would fire me. And not only that, I'd have no references and I would never get another job. And then I would lose the place I'm renting, and then I'd be homeless, and then I would die. All because you raised your hand. And so what we do is we seek reassurance. We seek reassurance. Please tell us it will be okay. We go to our coach and we say, coach, I want to try something new. Tell me it'll work out. We go to the pre-VC meeting and say, tell me what to say so that when I go to the meeting, it will all be okay. Reassure me. Reassurance is futile. There will never be enough reassurance for your lizard brain. Never. It doesn't make sense to look for it. Because the work you need to do, the most important work you can do, the speaking up at the meeting, the writing what needs to be written, the looking people in the eye, that work, the less reassurance we can give you, the more important the work is. That what is going on here in this new revolutionary time we live in is that the only thing we are keeping track of is not docs. We are keeping track of trust and connection and the stories we tell ourselves. And it's all invented. The story you are telling yourself about your competence and your incompetence, the story you are telling yourself about the outfit you wore today or the way people think about you or what money is, it's all invented. We invented a story because it worked for us. And the people in Bareilly, India have a totally different story about themselves or their money or their future than you do. And your story is totally different than his story. And it's all invented. And so the question we have to ask ourselves is not where will I find the reassurance, the foundation, the gentle hand on my back to guarantee me it's all going to be okay. Where can I find the authority so I can hide from the repercussions? These are the wrong questions. The right question is who needs to be seen? What change can I make? What connection can I make? What can I build? Excuse me, I've been ranting at you a long time. Okay, so I want to talk now about this idea called infinite games. James Karst wrote a book about it. You all are familiar with regular games, finite games, things like football games, soccer games, presidential elections. These are games that exist in our world with several attributes. There's a time limit, and somebody wins. And there are rules. Those are the three basic things. So we have games at work. We have games in traffic, right? There's two people trying to merge onto the highway. The person who goes first won that game. Lots of games in our life. But then there are these infinite games. Juggling is an infinite game. You can't win at juggling. You can just juggle. Playing catch with your four-year-old son is an infinite game. I hope the goal is not to throw the ball so hard that the kid quits. The goal is to throw the ball so he throws it back. And in a connection economy, which is different than the industrial economy, the infinite game is the game we are actually playing. We are not playing a game to cut someone else off in traffic. We are not playing the game to have our blog rank higher than someone else's blog. We're not even playing an SEO game, because that game's sort of rigged, and we're not going to be able to win it for long anyway. No, we're playing an infinite game. I'm throwing this ball to you so that you will throw it back. I am connecting with you so you will connect to her. I am weaving together the fabric of a community. New York Tech Meetup with 30,000 members. How do you win that? You don't win that, but you could weave it. And when you weave it, when you create this environment where people are able to see each other, find each other, do things together, enormous amounts of value are created. As Matt Ridley said, no one in this room knows how to make a computer mouse, not one person. You need a metals person, a plastics person, a software person, supply chain. Together, we're going to create value by working together as we work our way through it. And it is always too soon to take this leap. That when Gutenberg launched the printing press 500 years ago, only 7% of the people in Europe knew how to read. This was a really dumb time to launch the book. There were no bookstores. They had not yet invented reading glasses, which one-third of the addressable market needed, but didn't know because there was nothing to read. This was a dumb time to launch the book. He should have waited until Barnes & Noble was up and running and Amazon was getting started. Then he could have invented the book and it would have worked great. When Carl Benz launched the car, it was against the law to drive. There were no roads and there were no gas stations. There were no all-night drive-through liquor stores. He should have waited before he launched it. And so when we dig deep into what we are doing all day at work, the question is, what's it for? We're playing a game in our head that's all invented. Is it giving you pleasure and sustenance? Does it matter? Or is it about watching some ticker as the number goes up, waiting for the car in front of you to pull over so you can pass them? Because the internet could save your life. Because you have the opportunity to say, wait, I can write it down. I can notice things, imagine things, connect people, and then do things that actually matter. So I want to tell you a couple more stories. The first one is about a great charity in Boston and New York called Room to Grow. And what Room to Grow does is they find underprivileged moms who have young kids and they say to them, come here, we will welcome you, we'll give you some baby clothes, some gently used toys. Well, baby clothes and gently used toys are important, but that's not why it works. It works because someone in that office sees you. They would miss you. They look you in the eye. They care about you. They don't just care about you because it's their job. They care about you because they have chosen to do this. And over time, when someone notices you and cares about you and connects with you, that is the original social media. That is what we are trying to replicate with all of our buzzing and responsive mobile nonsense. What we're trying to replicate is not clicks or page views. We're trying to replicate this idea of being seen. So on to one of my favorite movies of all time, The Wizard of Oz. I want to talk about a couple things related to The Wizard of Oz. The first one is this. In 75 years, I can't think of five movies that have featured an intelligent, strong teenage girl as their hero. What a shame. But The Wizard of Oz did that, and it did it beautifully. Second thing about The Wizard of Oz, which I think will be instructive to everybody here who's trying to make something happen, is early in the movie, Dorothy goes to the wizard and explains what she wants. And the wizard says, I will help you, but first, bring me the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. He didn't need a broomstick. He had plenty of broomsticks. He was sending Dorothy away so she wouldn't come back. And there are all these people in your lives, when you go to them for reassurance, when you go to them to be picked, when you go to them for whatever you're going to them with, who say, first, bring me the broomstick. First, bring me the P&L. First, bring me a better PowerPoint deck. First, bring me a prototype. And they send you off, not because they need it, but because they don't want you to come back. And if you're spending your days looking for broomsticks, it might make sense to go back into the business of making tension instead. You can look at the wizard and pause, because that increases the tension. And say, really? Do we need a broomstick? Or is this about you needing more reassurance? Because if you need more reassurance, maybe I need a partner or an authority or a van driver that wants to make the same change that I want to make. Because plenty of projects have gone forward with far fewer broomsticks than you're asking for right now. And we've got to be clear with each other about who's on the spot and what change are we trying to make. The other thing that happens in the movie at the end is this, the penultimate epic scene. The wizard turns to the scarecrow and the tin man, et cetera, and says, you already had everything you needed. The lion, you already had the courage. Scarecrow, you are already smart. And the same thing is true for you. That you already have what you need to go to the next level. You don't need more ducks. You don't need more permission. You certainly don't need more reassurance. What you need instead is the decision to stop scratching imaginary itches, because they're all invented. My friend Pema Chodron talks about the difference between an itch and a scratch. An itch is something that happens to you. You didn't invent it, it's there. A scratch is something you choose to do. I can't make your itches go away. No one can make your itches go away. All the reassurance in the world is going to do nothing for your itches. But scratching is your choice. It's the choice to take your eye off the ball, to take your eye off what it is you sought to do all along, and just work on this thing, this lizard thing, this resistance thing, this made-believe writer's block, and take yourself away from what it is you could have been doing all along. Okay, so the last thing I want to talk about before I start to wrap this up is this. I've been thinking a bunch over the last couple of months about what marketing is now. How is it that people, when confronted with your art, when confronted with your contribution, when confronted with the tension you are making, how do they decide to make a thing, to do a thing, to go forward? And I think it comes down to one simple sentence. People like us do things like this. When someone in LA is thinking of joining the Crips or the Bloods, they don't say, well, do you have any brochures? They look around and they say, is this the sort of thing someone like me does? That when I was in Kenya working with Western Seed, we were trying to help local farmers decide, choose, to stop doing what they had been doing for 100 years, which is plant the seeds they had saved from the year before, and instead buy seeds designed to grow more corn. For $30, they could buy $2,000 worth of harvest. And only one-third of the farmers were buying it. One-third of the farmers were saying, yeah, I'll do that. And two-thirds were doing what they'd always done. Because people like me do things like this. This is what my neighbors do. This is what my dad did. People like me do things like this. The answer is not to make better corn. The answer is not a better label for your corn. The answer is not billboards for your corn. The answer is not tweeting about your corn. The answer is changing the culture from a culture of we've always done it this way to a culture of I'll give that a try. So I spent the day with a woman named Lucy. Lucy is now a millionaire. She keeps 1 million Kenyan shillings under her bed. She, on the same amount of land her neighbors have, she grows enough corn and has a taxi company and a tree farm that she's put all 9 of her kids through private school. And her neighbor is a subsistence farmer. What's the difference? The difference is, Lucy says, when something new shows up, I'll try it. You won't get much land from me, but I'll try it. She's a nerd. And the farmers in Iowa are all nerds. The farmers in Iowa are constantly showing each other not their new iPhone, but their new yield. Everyone in Iowa knows what everybody else is planting. It's not a secret, because Iowa doesn't compete with Iowa. Iowa competes with Nebraska. So everyone tells everyone else. In Lucy's neighborhood, no one told anybody else. So the job wasn't to sell corn. The job was to get people in town to talk to each other, because people like us do things like this. Let me compare the great Ella Fitzgerald to the disgraced Richard Nixon for a minute. In the 1950s, Ella Fitzgerald went on tour, and she had an integrated lineup, black musicians, white musicians. They went to Houston. They went to Houston, Ella said, because Houston needed it. She needed to bring tension to that theater in Houston because she wanted people to see what could happen if musicians integrated. In between her first performance and the second set, the cops busted down the door of her dressing room and arrested her and Illinois Jacquette and several other musicians for playing dice in their dressing room. And they took them to jail. They didn't do it because they were playing dice. They did it to humiliate them because they are the authorities, and the authorities don't like change, and the authorities don't like tension. So there is the magnificent Ella Fitzgerald in her gown. You can see the photos online. Fortunately, she was bailed out in time to make it back for the second show. This is somebody who showed up to do some work that mattered. Contrast that with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, who was certain to win re-election, was so in need of reassurance that he blew the whole thing so he could get just a little bit more confidence. He blew the whole thing by breaking all the oaths he had taken because he needed more reassurance. One person, even though he was the president, was a cog in a giant system that was just measuring the ratchets. And the other person was doing everything she could to make a change happen. It is entirely possible you can find someone who will give you second violin lessons, but they're really not worth taking. That what's available to us now, because we have this keyboard, because we have this megaphone, because we have this amplifier, what's available to us now is the chance to play first violin before we are qualified. That is the only time we get the chance to become qualified. When we act as if, when we stand on the spot, when we choose to accept the tension because it matters. So let me repeat something I said early on tonight. Leonard Bernstein said it. I hope you'll help me finish the sentence. I'm not sure what the question is, but the answer?
Yes.
Thanks very much.